Okay. Well, I've just sent out to everyone the .NET GUI proposal, which I have been working off of for the last several months, just so you all could kind of follow along as I talk through this. Basically, we've been consulting with various members of the ICANN community, in particular the IP community, law enforcement, registrars, registries, the privacy advocacy committee, the community, the technical community, and various privacy experts. The reason that we are talking about a proposed new .NAME Who is that since we've launched, we've come across a couple of challenges. One is that because we are a UK company, we are required to abide by certain obligations that we've agreed with the UK Data Commissioner. In particular, the UK Data Commissioner was obviously very sensitive to the fact that because we are a GTLD, information, personal information about registrants would be published in Whois. So the compromise that the UK Commissioner was willing to make was that we would publish personal information about the registrant, but would not publish phone and email information. So we've complied with that technically, but what we've discovered in actually launching the .NAME registry is that because it's uniquely an individual space, there's often only one contact. And as we all know, there are registrant, admin, tech, and billing contacts within Whois, whether it's for .com, .net, .name, .biz. And so registrant information, particularly the phone information and email information, is simply getting republished in the other fields. Another challenge that we're coming across is that partners who are willing to sell .name, whether as digital identity or as a product to their consumers, their individual consumers, is that they're very concerned about privacy issues and have a few of them have indicated that they're willing to use other means of kind of anonymizing their consumers. And so what we want to do is not have to sort of resort to such draconian measures, because with a third party or a, you know, anonymizing service, I think we all realize that it's costly, and B, it's another hurdle that legitimate searches will have to go through in order to get information. So what we've done is we've talked to several people within the community and taken into account their issues, as well as have come up with our own solution. And so if you follow along with me in the three-page paper that I've just put out, I can kind of walk you through what that structure will look like.
Just one point that I think it's apparent to everyone, but I think we ought to start out by just refreshing everyone's memory about the uniqueness of the .name space.
Yeah.
And maybe you could just say a couple of words about that before we walk through this.
Sure. The reason that we come across these Whois challenges is that .name is uniquely an individual space. I mean, the TLD was established for the purpose of use by individuals and not organizations or corporate entities. As you can see here in the second paragraph, the .name TLD is intended for individuals and for personal use. All registrants will be required to certify their bona fide interest in registering a domain name for personal use, and they may be required to produce evidence of this interest in the event of a dispute. And so again, you have these Whois on a four-tiered level: registrant, tech, admin, and billing. And for purposes of .name, we believe that information is really quite redundant. The other thing is that for the most part, the use of .name is really restricted to use by individuals as opposed to corporations or larger organizations.
Or businesses or entities engaged in business. I think
the very personal nature of the space means that what you're going to get is, you know, families using it to share personal information or pictures or whatnot, as opposed to being engaged in the kinds of commercial activities where, for example, consumers would need to be able to contact a business, find out whether, you know, why something they had ordered wasn't being delivered.
That's right. So just as a matter of background, I can kind of explain to you all what .namewho is currently looks like. What we propose to do is simply, there's a difference in the way that the information is disseminated, but not really a difference in what information is there. There are four layers of whois currently. There is summary, standard, detailed, and extensive. Our summary level really contains the least amount of information. It's simply whether a dot name exists. Our standard level contains information, but does not contain information, personally identifiable information. Detailed contains the four levels that we just discussed, but does not include the registrant's phone number and email information. The extensive whois, which was designed really with intellectual property and law enforcement in mind, contains what detailed contains, but does not contain, I'm sorry, but does contain the phone number and email address of registrants. And the way that you currently get extensive whois is that you actually do a, you know, small application on the .name website. You provide your name, your address, your email address, and you certify that you're, you know, using this information for legitimate purposes. Now, the way that you currently get this extensive information is you get it via email. So you provide all this information about yourself as a searcher, and you get basically an instantaneous email back with all the whois information that you need. So what we propose to do for our new whois is keep the two basic whois levels the same. So there's no change in summary or standard whois. What would change is detailed and extensive whois. And the way that we would want to change it, again, is not really the content of the information or the structure of the information, but rather the way you get the information. So as a general matter, we will firewall whois so that the information is available, but it's available only through access, through password access. For detailed whois, you would go through a similar process as you do now for our extensive whois. So you provide your name, your address, certain information about yourself, that you're using this information for legitimate search.
And if I could just interrupt, that
sure.
You're using it for a legitimate search. There is a great deal of flexibility in the, you know, the varieties of legitimate uses, because obviously whois is used by the technical community for one thing, by law enforcement for another, by, you know, intellectual property holders or other rights holders for an entirely different purpose. The one thing that is clearly not permitted would be use of this for any marketing purpose.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit of an echo. So.
Yeah, I think we all are. Hold on just a minute. That's Ken, right?
Yes.
Is this a good place to stop and take questions? Because others may have questions too, and we could just catch up on any questions up to this point.
You know, Ken, do you mind if I actually just finish describing?
Not at all, Karen. Why don't you just let me know when you're ready for
the
questions?
Okay, because I think people do have questions, as I explained, but I think it'll be better to take questions at the end. So what will happen is there will be a short application on the .name website. There will be a fee per five searches. And the fee, we have $2 in brackets here, you know, per five searches. But the fee here is really not the amount of the fee that's important, but it's really the fact that there is some accountability here. If you're a marketer or if you're a criminal, you're less likely to want to pay the fee or to provide credit card information, thereby creating a trail by using a credit card. So with this application and this fee payment, you get access, you get a password that is accessible, that accesses the Whois database for five searches. And you get that via an email back. So it basically works the same way as our extensive, except instead of getting the Whois information, you get a password that allows you access into our database. Now, the extensive Whois, you will be able to get a persistent password that you won't have, there's no limitation as to how many searches you do, but you get this via an agreement with...
And there's no charge.
What we did was we took the model zone file access agreement and we conformed it to, or we, you know, kind of tailored it to the needs of sort of what we saw for Whois access. And so requesters, be they an IP firm, a registrar, the FBI, whatever it is, they'll enter into the simple agreement with us, and they make representations that they are using this password and the Whois information for legitimate purposes. And we actually ask within this agreement for this legitimate purpose to be described. Becky, I'll kind of let you describe the agreement in further detail.
Okay. The agreement is, again, as in all of the efforts here, what we've tried to do is have a relatively easily self-administering program that will slow down people who might misuse Whois data. So there is a requirement that you either specify that your use fits into some designated categories, or if it doesn't fit into those designated categories, that you articulate what your use is. We require an acknowledgement that if you use the Whois data in a way that is inconsistent with the requirements of the license, then you're liable to GNR for any damages GNR suffers. Now, as a matter of law, you are, whether you sign that or not. But this is just an articulation of that. There's also a provision that says we will keep track of searches that are done on Whois, and they will be made available in the event of misuse. And the other stuff is fairly standard, but it essentially creates a fairly readily used record of who is going to have access to the full panoply of Whois data on a regular basis. And the point to that being that this data is being put up on a website, it's being transmitted all over the world in the views of, for example, European data protection commissioners. And with data, the level of access provided needs to be commensurate with the, needs of the legitimate needs of the person seeking that information and the legitimate needs of the data subject. I might add that, the question of Whois data with respect to individuals has been a topic that, that we've been discussing since, the first issue of ICANN and domain name management came up. There's always been a recognition on the one hand that there are privacy issues related to Whois data, and on the other hand, that there are very serious and compelling needs from the technical perspective and from law enforcement and a whole bunch of other perspectives to have this data available. And this is a situation where, because it is an individual namespace, we think the balance sort of tilts in a different direction, and in this case, it's worth making it somewhat more, not really difficult, but somewhat more time-consuming, or something a little bit more rigorous to get access to the data.
Structured.
I think that's exactly right. The other issue, obviously, is that GNR is located in the UK, where the UK data protection law applies, and they obviously are required to abide by that. And we would like to bring this into a high level of compliance, so that we don't risk having a situation where it, is where the data protection or the information commissioner in the UK demands that it be taken offline altogether, because that would defeat the legitimate purposes of the data. So this is a balance. It doesn't mean that WHOIS data will never be misused, but it certainly makes it less likely that it will be misused by spammers, and I think less likely that it will be misused by casually by, stalkers or something like that.
Okay, are we ready to open for a queue for questions then?
Sure.
Tony, did you want to add anything before, did you want to make any comments before we went through a queue?
No, I think we're going fine. Just go ahead.
Okay. Can I ask anyone who hasn't identified themselves who's joined the call, can you tell us who you are?
You just heard me going out of mute mode.
Okay.
Marilyn, Troy Daz joined.
Hi, Troy.
Is Andrew McLaughlin on the call?
Yes, I am.
Oh, hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Good. Then I think we are ready to do a queue, and Ken, I had you first.
Thank you, Marilyn. A couple of issues that I'm somewhat, I won't say concerned with, but I think need a little bit more elaboration. I appreciate the idea that on the highly restricted access, you do have some sort of an agreement, but it would seem to me that enforceability here might be somewhat nebulous, and I think as an individual, I would want to know that there would be some teeth in there, and it seems to me that the agreement is worded in such a way as if damage is done to GNR. I'm just wondering whether or not you have any way of putting more teeth in this, number one. And number two, have you thought about doing something that mailing list management people have done for years, and that is salting the database so that, if necessary, you can track down the abuses back to specific users?
I think that the traditional and, I guess, increasingly sophisticated mailing list management techniques would certainly need to be put into place so that, if a database, a WHOIS database, was being misused, the registry in this case would have early warning of that. The issue with respect to enforceability is an interesting question, and again, of course, it is a balance. The one thing that we don't think is workable for most of the community that needs to get access to this data is something along the lines of, a mechanism that would turn the data subject into a third-party beneficiary, so that, for example, if their information was misused, they could sue the misuser directly. Now, obviously, if their information is used in violation of the data protection law in the jurisdiction that they reside, there is a significant chance, especially if they're in one of the jurisdictions that has data protection laws, omnibus data protection laws, but also, frankly, in our states, many of which have anti-spam laws, they can, you know, they have recourse against GNR. And GNR, in turn, would have recourse against the users of the data. But because we expect that a significant number of users will be a law enforcement and government who are certainly, at least in the United States, have no authority to enter into a contract that would create third-party beneficiary liability, that's not really going to work. Also, because, you know, there is some potential in those situations for you know, abuse of that kind of system. So the balance here is to say we understand that GNR will be liable to the data subjects. We understand that there is an increasingly aggressive enforcement of international data protection laws. And we are going to have the information that is necessary for GNR to enforce its license by virtue of the information that you are required to provide when you sign up for an account and by virtue of the tracks that you leave when you use the service.
Thanks, Becky. The only thing I'm concerned about is I just, while we were talking here, I just went through the last 20 or 30 pieces of spam that I've gotten in the last 24 hours, and I'm probably no different than most of you. I would hate to have a circumstance where the only thing I got from GNR, because I do have two of registrations with them, was, gee, we're sorry. You know, I'd like to have some sort, if I'm a user and if I'm relying on GNR from that standpoint, I'd like to have some sort of assurances that you're operating on something more than just a representation from an individual. And I think that if you're going to stratify a database like that, you should restrict it pretty significantly. And I'll give you examples. For instance, if somebody is using it for IP purposes, the presumption should be that they're a member of a local bar or you know, accredited legal professional. I'd be quite concerned about opening the access up to somebody on a representation.
Well, of course, now there is no, you know, normally when you access who is a database, there's no representation whatsoever. Or there might be a representation that says by using this database, you know, you are going to, you agree not to use it in a way that's prohibited. So this goes a step further, which is to say it gives GNR the means to enforce it. The other thing is, I think, you know, all of the registries and registrars are quite concerned, and ISPs certainly, quite concerned about the use of their systems for spam. So I would imagine that would be something that GNR would be fairly aggressive about. And finally, you know, the other balance that has to be considered here is the business constraints of the registry and registrar models. And, you know, every bell and whistle that gets added that enhances enforceability requires additional resources to manage. And so what we're trying to do is find a balance. It certainly isn't perfect. I
understand that, Beck, and I guess the only thing I'm saying is, on the other hand, adding a bell and a whistle that gives a registry an additional marketing tool to attract additional business. So it's the theory of incremental revenue versus incremental expenses.
Right,
absolutely. Can we
go on with the queue? Let me take some names, and then we'll work through.
Yeah, I would like to get in the queue, Melon, please.
And this is Philip.
Yes.
This is Steve Metallitz. I'd like to get in the queue, please.
Did I hear Thomas earlier?
Yes.
This is Sarah. I'd like to ask a question.
So I had Philip, I had Thomas, I had Steve, I had Sarah. Anyone else? Why don't we start with Philip?
Let me ask another question. Understanding that one of the main purposes of this proposal is to be in high compliance with the expectation and the needs of UK, and I think, you know, due to the fact that a lot of the national data protection laws in Europe are based on European guidelines, to be in high compliance with the European data protection guidelines. From my experience talking to data, of course, the national data protection officers, there are two problems in compliance with WHOIS. One is the problem, the content of the WHOIS and the exact access to the WHOIS. And I see that in the proposal, and I heard about that. And I saw another problem, or I heard another problem, is the transfer from data, you know, from countries which are considered safe under data protection regulation and laws, which are most European countries are considered safe, in non-safe countries. Is that something you discussed with the UK Data Protection Commissioner, or was that not of your concern at that point of time?
Well, I think inherent in the concern with the Data Protection Commissioner and the discussion about WHOIS is the fact that by putting something up on a web server, the information can be transferred to anybody in any part of the world that has internet access. So that is, you know, sort of inherently part of the issue, and one of the compliance challenges is to make sure that if it's transferred to countries that are determined or that have not been determined to have adequate data protection laws, it's transferred under circumstances that provide for adequate protection to the data. Now, having said that, the Data Protection Commissioners will certainly balance the nature of the data, which in this case is generally not highly sensitive data, with the legitimate uses of the data by people who are entitled to access. So the answer to your question is that certainly is a concern. It is a major concern of the data protection authorities, and compliance is a requirement for GNR.
Thank you.
Becky, I'm not exactly sure I understood the answer in relation to safe harbor countries or other countries, though.
Yeah, that was my question, Melvin. Thank you.
I mean, there is no answer. There's no mechanism that would say, okay, Microsoft has joined the safe harbor, so any request for WHOIS data coming from Microsoft, an IP address controlled by Microsoft, should be okay. I mean, the mechanisms that you would use to limit data transfers based on the location of the searcher,
right,
are very difficult and not particularly,
right,
well developed.
Right.
So it's not practical to take that approach. And indeed, there are a number of companies in the United States that have entirely legitimate uses for that data, but have not joined the safe harbor for one reason or another. Another mechanism that is, viewed as an acceptable alternative to the safe harbor is a contractual undertaking.
Right.
And this is certainly not a standard model contract that's been approved by the Commission, but it is an approach to the transfer that takes the contract approach as opposed to the status of the recipient.
I see. And so even though this is not a today an existing approved contract, it could fit under that concept of contractual agreement.
Yes, that is the point.
Got it. Sorry, Philip, are you okay? Should we go into Thomas?
Absolutely. I think we've confirmed at a later stage we can discuss that again, but I'm okay for the moment.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Since we have still quite a lot of an echo, I have two questions. The first one is a rather basic one about the proposal. From the paper circulated by Karen, I understand that under the new proposal, detailed who is would be accessible to everyone who is willing to pay the fee. I did not completely understand to whom extensive who is would be accessible. Is that just accessible to everyone who enters into the agreements mentioned, or are there further qualifications?
In both cases, it is neither someone who simply is willing to pay the fee or someone who simply is willing to enter into the contract. In addition to either paying the fee or entering into the contract, they have to, one, articulate a legitimate use of the data that does not include using it for marketing purposes, and two, that is the basic requirement. The difference between the two is, on the one hand, you're getting a limited use only, so the amount of information collected from the person getting that information is significantly less than the amount of information that is collected from somebody who is entering into the extensive agreement and getting a password that enables them to access the database repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so actually that triggers another question, which is, however, somewhat related to the one I was going to ask anyway. So, two things. First of all, if, given the characterization of detailed and extensive access you just gave, why should anyone enter into the detailed mode of access when he can get the extensive one by just entering into that kind of agreement? And I seem to understand that detailed access includes some conditions which would have to be similar to that agreement. So I'm wondering what the detailed access is actually needed for. The second thing, if I may just ask the second question so you can answer both in bulk. The second thing is about what you said concerning users as third party beneficiaries of a contract between GNR and other users. I seem to recall that you mentioned something along the lines that GNR would be liable to the user, and then GNR would pass on the damage caused to the data user. Now the problem with that is, of course, that a normal net user will have a very hard time to make to actually hold GNR liable when he gets some spam from somewhere. It will be extremely difficult to handle in practice, and so I'm really wondering if it wouldn't be a good idea to actually include end users as third-party beneficiaries with the contract, but to waive that part of the data use agreement for public authorities who enter into the agreement in order to address the concern you mentioned earlier. So if the data user is a private entity, the data user would enter into an agreement with the data subject as a third-party beneficiary. If the data user is a public entity, then there would be no third-party beneficiary. I suppose that this could be more helpful for end users than a version where you would have to sue GNR first.
Well, I understand both of your questions, and let me say, I think that anybody who regularly expects to access Whois data would take advantage of the extensive agreement rather than the detailed. The detailed is there simply for somebody who has a very occasional use or has a one-time use and doesn't expect to need it again. And wants to provide less information about themselves. With respect to the third-party beneficiary, I think we need to keep two things in mind. First of all, the UK Data Protection Commissioner has not required that with respect to this data. The data itself is not not rise to the level of sensitivity that brought the UK Data Protection Commissioner in her review of this suggests that we needed third-party beneficiary liability. Second of all, I think that if we introduced the notion of third-party beneficiary liability, there would be a very, very significant slowdown in the process of bringing this kind of privacy protection to individual users on the Internet. I think that it would be a non-starter from a number of business perspectives, not just the intellectual property community, but many, many, many businesses that might be subject to being sued, you know, legitimately or not, on the basis of this information. So our thought here was that we wanted to put together something that would be that would enhance security for privacy for individuals without creating unacceptable barriers for businesses, on the hopes that we could move this forward relatively. Those of us involved in the privacy debates, at least in the United States, know what a red flag the third-party beneficiary issue sends up for U.S. businesses. And I think it would mean that Internet users will not get this kind of enhanced protection for a significantly longer time.
Are you okay, Thomas? Can we move to Steve?
Okay.
Steve?
Yes, thank you. I really just wanted to make two points. One, on the third-party beneficiary issue, I would agree with Becky that this would be a very complicated, this would open a lot of issues. You know, all of the contracts that now govern not only who is, but a lot of other issues dealing with the relationship between registrars and registries and ICANN rule out third-party beneficiaries. And if this were to be opened here, in other words, if there were to be a contractual framework that allows for third-party beneficiaries in this case, I think you'd have to look at a lot of other instances and ask whether, for example, the registrars who are insulated from third-party beneficiary liability now really ought to maintain that status. So I think it would initiate a host of complications, and not only is there a cause of action against GNR, but in many countries, many jurisdictions, if you think about the types of misuse that might occur, there would also be a cause of action directly against the misusing party. So I don't think it's necessary to extend third-party beneficiary rights to the registrants in this case. The other point I would make, and I guess I would be interested in Becky and Karen's reaction to this, is that I think there are a lot of there's a lot of appeal to these this approach and concept. There are also a lot of practical issues involving really making a big innovation here. For the first time in the history of the Internet, Whois access would be governed on a contractual basis, and that's never been the case before anywhere, at least in the GTLD space. I think you mentioned that there may be problems with the access of law enforcement, requiring the law enforcement to enter into a contractual agreement in order to gain full access to Whois data. The same could be true with a lot of private sector requesters, just on a practical basis, because in many cases the purpose of Whois access or the need for Whois access is contracted out to other parties. Lawyers would be one of them, as Ken points out, but there are many others that might be involved. So it institutes a host of practical problems, and I guess I would be interested in what reaction you have gotten, potential from law enforcement or from government officials about the idea that in order for them to get the same kind of access to who is that they can get now and they have to enter into a contractual agreement?
We have spoken to a number of law enforcement authorities, largely in the U.S. today, but from a different variety. So, for example, from a consumer perspective, consumer protection perspective, as well as from a more traditional law enforcement like the FBI to the Computer Crimes Division at the Department of Justice. And the extensive agreement that you see now is the product of input, especially from the Consumer Protection Authority in the U.S. We would need to retain some flexibility with respect to certain provisions when contracting with government agencies. So, for example, the Federal Trade Commission in the United States does not have the authority to enter into a contract where governing law is the law of England. And likewise, I assume that the French, CNIL, or the any other law enforcement agency can only enter into contracts that are governed by French law. So that is a provision that we would need to retain some flexibility over. But otherwise, the concern is that they want ready access to it. They want a system that works. They certainly want to be able to say, you are not, but we do not want you to make our searches public. So we would obviously have to agree with respect to a law enforcement agency that if somebody came and said, I want to see all of the searches that have done on my name, we would not be able to turn over searches conducted by the Federal Trade Commission or the Inland Revenue Division or whatever. But beyond that, the basic idea of a contract, so long as it's readily administrable and doesn't impose enormous burdens or burdens that they are prohibited by law from entering into. They have been generally willing to do this. And I might say that, that we have some hope that if you offer users some additional privacy protection, they will be more likely to provide accurate information. So although this is certainly not the primary objective, we hope that there will be some ancillary benefit of improved quality in the database.
Okay, can we move on? I think we have, in the queue that we have right now, we have Sarah, and then I'll take anyone else who speak after that.
Thanks, Marilyn. I think Becky just answered one of my questions, was that whether individuals can get access to the requests made on their name. And I think Becky said that they could. I'm just wondering under what circumstances they can do that.
Well, the general circumstance would be that you would have the right to ask for information about searches conducted on your name. The sort of default would be, and I think, I don't know, this may not be in the document, would be that there would be an expectation that information would be provided. However, law enforcement, for example, would be notified in advance of disclosure of that information. Likewise, if you are conducting searches for on behalf of trademark holders or copyright holders, you would not want that information released in a way that undermines your investigation. So while the default would be that if you asked for it, you could get a copy of the information about who has searched for information about you, system will have to be flexible enough to accommodate the needs of those who have to require some ability to maintain the privacy of their searches.
Can I do a follow-up on that real quick?
Of course, Ken, and then I have a question as well. So
okay, only because it's right on point with that.
Yes, go ahead.
How do you determine from a qualitative standpoint when to make a decision? I can understand if the Federal Bureau of Investigation or Interpol or somebody wants information, but there has to be some sort of a benchmark for determining whether or not you're going to disclose to the individual that is information on his name.
There are two ways of doing this. I mean, one, I would expect that a certain category of users will essentially say, you know, we want to be notified of every request, and we want to have the right to object to the disclosure of that information. I think that there are two ways you could approach this. One, you could investigate every ID recipient, every password recipient, and decide whether it was legitimate for them to, request information not to be released. The other is that you could say that the fact that you have blocked the release of information is also another fact that will be retained. And if there was, for example, somebody was blocking this for the purpose of abusing or misusing Hulu's data, that the fact that they blocked it would be another fact that would help somebody make the case that they were acting in bad faith. So, this is a balance between a foolproof system that provides great privacy protection and a system that creates accountability with respect to the use of Whois data. And clearly this is much more a system that is designed to enhance privacy by creating accountability with respect to the use of the data, as opposed to simply taking the approach of preventing.
Okay.
Did that answer your question, Ken?
Yeah, thanks, Becky. I appreciate it.
Becky, I have a question, and then I'll go back to see if anyone else does. As I understand the business problem that .name is trying to solve, it is an effort to be in compliance with requirements by the UK data privacy law that would govern the data that is gathered, how is it accessed, and where it is transferred, and et cetera. But the second point that you guys are talking about, which is to provide to the registrant information about the fact someone has done a Whois database as a search, that is not actually required by the data privacy law. Is that right?
Well, it's a funny thing. It's hard to know what's required by any data protection law, but I think that is right. It is not a requirement. If you have a legitimate reason for making information available to somebody, then generally the data protection laws would, in fact, protect the privacy of the searcher. So the fault would actually be the other way around, which is to say, if you have information, if by disclosing information to a data subject about searches on their name, you disclose information about somebody else, then the data protection laws would not require you to make that disclosure, notwithstanding the sort of general access provisions in data protection law.
But But aren't you? I mean, we can take this offline. But if you are disclosing information about the searcher, you could be also disclosing personally identifiable information.
Right. That's exactly what I'm saying, Marilyn. The default would be you can't disclose it.
I see. The other question that I had is really a question about the plan that you have to charge $2, and it's just a question because in the past, one time many years ago, AT&T owned a credit card company. My God, what haven't we done? But in those days, we were unhappy about charges of very low amounts because of the cost of the processing fee. But did I understand you correctly to say that you were proposing to accept charges of only $2? That was just question one. And then question two, the subscription service now is not fee-based, but that could change in the future?
Two things. One, frankly, we have not discussed the level of charges with credit card companies.
Yeah.
So we frankly don't know. I suspect you're right. There is some threshold in which they are willing to provide the service and some threshold in which they aren't. There are alternative payment services like PayPal that might be more appropriate for this. But I think, you know, that is one of the issues that definitely has to be worked through. And your second question was, I'm sorry, Marilyn, what was the second part of your question?
Well, before I go to the second question, let me just ask, PayPal, meaning that I would have to, the searcher would have to go out and sign up for a third-party service like PayPal, or .name would offer an easy-to-register process.
Well, that's an interesting idea. We haven't discussed it, but it might be that works. I mean, one of the issues, obviously, is whenever we start talking about credit cards, there's significant availability of credit cards in the United States and in Western States and in other parts of the world, significantly less. So that is one of the issues that we have not fully addressed.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting idea.
My second question had to do with the subscription service today doesn't have a fee,
but
have a fee in the future?
Well, the way the extensive agreement is set up is that any change to the fee structure would have to be approved by ICANN as a modification to the contract between ICANN and GNR. So while there is a mechanism for making such a change, it would certainly not be something that was undertaken either lightly or without, as in all things related to ICANN, significant public discussion.
As I understand it, you're fielding this idea with the idea that .name is a unique space. It has different characteristics. There are qualifications, so to speak, about who can register in .name. There's the ability to challenge someone registered in .name if they, in fact, they're not an individual. And so the goal here is to try to establish a sort of a carve out for a very unique space.
Yes, we see .name as a space that is tailored to individuals and that therefore raises a host of privacy issues that are not that don't arise in the general commercial space.
Well, Becky, and I think that one concern that I would ask, and we take comments on it, is the what we in business call the flashback opportunity. Flashback means you can agree to something in one space, but you really couldn't tolerate it or agree to it in another. And could you I don't know if that's something that would be on the minds of, you know, if, let's just say hypothetically, with all the parameters that have been described and the safeguards, one could agree to a unique who is access, because you're not saying the data won't be gathered, you're saying unique who is access. But there would have to be, I think, a clear understanding that that is not precedent setting for the modification or establishment of who is policies in other different kinds of names. And I might just take a comment on that. I'm not necessarily from you and and Karen, but from the group. The concept of unique is access for personal space. Will it have consequences for other kinds of, like, the open generic?
This is Steve Metallic. I would agree that that is a concern here. And I think .name is certainly intended for use by individuals. Whether, in fact, it is being used by individuals is another question. Obviously it is, but to what extent it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, this there would be a concern about this, about whether or to what extent this this solution would be precedent-setting for other TLDs.
Right, and I think it would be, you know, significantly problematic if the fact that the access to WHIS data changed in this case caused commercial backup, sorry, I have a one-year-old in my detail, bad actors to flock to .name. There is, you know, we have looked at the studies about usage of .name, and while it's very early, even those places where it's not individuals, it does appear to be registration device for personal purposes. So that's something GNR is going to have to monitor as a matter of course.
Right, and I think the other thing that is compelling and uniquely .name is that, you know, we are a registry that is located in the UK and therefore subject to the UK data, the UK data privacy laws, which other open gTLDs do not have that same sort of issue.
Anything, any other comments from anyone else about this particular point? If not...
Okay, then I will take my leave. Thank you very much, Marilyn, for putting this together, and thanks everybody else.
One question in general about one earlier point, if that's possible. I would like to come back to Marilyn's question about privacy protection for those who perform searches. I think that there should be some rules in British privacy law which actually regulate this, because in the European Directive on Data Privacy you have Articles 11 and 12 which regulate some information and which regulate some, what information is to be given to the data subject in the case of a transfer of data and in the case of use of data. And this very makes rather clear that individuals generally that the data subject generally has the right to know who is using the data and to whom the data is being transferred for what purpose. And as far as I see it, the directive actually does this in the form of a rule with exceptions, and the exceptions are normally to be interpreted in a narrow manner in this case. And I'm actually not sure that all the exceptions which were mentioned by Becky earlier are indeed covered by this list in the European Union directive, so this may need some more review. And I think it's something to be to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Thomas. Becky, again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much. I'll talk to you all later. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Becky.
I'm going to move us to the quick review of the agenda. Quick review of the agenda, what we're trying to accomplish, and then what I'd like to do is ask Andrew, if you would, Andrew, maybe to very quickly just some of the points from your presentation in Bucharest, which are, again, sort of about the experience in talking with others about quiz. And we did distribute your presentation, but not everyone from the task force was there. And if you could just maybe take a few minutes to explain to the task force what you were trying to accomplish by putting that event together, and what you sort of see the environment to be that you think that that presentation was trying to address. I think that would be very helpful for all of us.
Okay, I can do that very quickly. The purpose of the session in Bucharest, which was well attended by the board members, was to prepare them for what was to come in the coming months and in Shanghai, which is to say, starting to think seriously about who is issues. The basic purpose of my presentation was to encapsulate the very simple point that these issues are complicated, that there are a number of competing interests on different sides, and that the basic core principle of free, publicly available who is one that requires some, you know, careful thought to enact in practical terms. I think that really was the thrust of my presentation. What we were hoping to do was to throw up a real-world example of the problems that .name was confronting, to give the Whois task force a chance to update everybody on the status and conclusions of its work thus far. And then finally, we had a presentation from the OECD lawyer to show in a pretty well-documented case what goes wrong for users trying to solve real-world domain name problems when the Whois data is neither free, it is free but not accurate. And I thought that was a pretty enlightening case study. So that really was it. I don't think I need to take up any more time going into the details, because they'll be very familiar to all of you on this call.
Let me reference for all of you that the real-time captioning is now available on this particular event, and it's actually a pretty quick read. If you weren't there and want to read through it, it is available on the ICANN site. You might want to take a quick run through it if you haven't had a chance to do that. What we wanted to do at this point was to talk about our recommendations and get a bit of a feel as a group and with some consultation with Andrew on where those recommendations require policy changes, where they could fit into existing policy, and try to scope out really what the next stage of our work needs to be. And just for a refresher for everyone, we had come up with four areas of concern: accuracy, uniformity and consistency, searchability, and marketing, resale, and bulk access. And then we did recommendations under each of those four areas. And I think if we could go through each of those areas and talk about whether ICANN has existing policy in place, and if so, whether we are merely into an enforcement or implementation question, or whether policy changes are needed, I think that would be very helpful for us in trying to scope the next stage of our work. Is that acceptable to everyone?
Sounds okay with me.
Okay. Let's start with accuracy, which is the easy one. Steve, I might put you on the spot if I could. I think in our previous discussions, I think you and I have felt that most of the provisions that are needed, and this has been documented in our present draft report, we think that most of the provisions necessary to begin to address the accuracy problem should be implemented, but it's a question of how to get them implemented and enforced, and a question of assessing how that change would happen within the registrar databases. Is that, and I guess it's three databases for the thick registries.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. There are provisions in these agreements that would help to improve accuracy, and there is some ability for ICANN to provide more detail of, as to what's required. ICANN has taken one step in that with a registrar advisory that came out in May, but there could be more done along that line. I think one point that we flag in our recommendations that I'd be interested in Andrew's comments on is the question of whether graduated sanctions or some type of enforcement other than revocation of accreditation of a of an accredited registrar, how we would go about achieving that recommendation, because as I read the agreements, it looks like the only sanction that can be applied for example, failure to carry out these WHOIS data quality steps would be disaccreditation.
And yeah, and so the question to Andrew is: is there a method to have intermediate enforcement processes? And would that require policy, or could that be worked out at a staff level based on the not so much at a staff level, but based on the existing accreditation agreements without a policy change? Is that right?
Well, it would take a change to the agreements, and I think we should all want a change in the agreements, because if intermediate sanctions are actually going to be enforceable, then they've got to be part of the written contract between ICANN and a given registrar. So you know, that presents the usual headaches that renegotiation of those contracts presents. But it seems to me that for many of the registrars that are interested in seeing ICANN be a more effective enforcer of its agreements, there probably would be a lot of support for the idea of intermediate sanctions in order to make it more realistic that ICANN can enforce individual provisions on an individual basis. So, you know, my feeling about this has long been that intermediate sanctions make a good deal of sense. They will raise a whole host of concerns from the registrars. I don't think those concerns are unanswerable, but if there was a clear sentiment from the WHOIS task force that this is something that's essential to the construction of a sensible WHOIS mechanism going forward, I think the response from the staff would be, okay, let's figure out with the registrars how we can go about finding a contractual home for that kind of a provision. In this case, this is one of those areas where I don't think it's so much, we shouldn't think so much in terms of policy. It's more just a question of sensible contract enforcement mechanisms. If the policy requirement is, you know, these are the obligations of accredited registrars, what we're now talking about is providing registrars with some kind of sanction short of loss of accreditation. They might view that as a benefit, because outside of the WHOIS context in particular, it would enable ICANN to more readily come down on registrars who are failing to meet their obligations.
And I guess my view, and I'd be interested in opening this up for a comment, but my view is if it's not addressed, that we are going to see the problems with accuracy that we see, and I've done a little bit of an internal analysis, and we see a very high percentage of inaccuracy. I say that there are probably, I think there's something, there are probably at least three reasons for inaccuracy. One of them is data that ages, and it becomes inaccurate just because it ages, and changes happen inside a company, and that change is not updated. That's not malicious, but it has a negative impact on ISPs and on trademark holders and on law enforcement people who want to cooperate aren't reachable. And we've seen some impact of that even on the transfers notification and the deletions notification. The second thing that I see is data that is inaccurate by accident. Somebody fills in the wrong information in the wrong field, or they are using different registrars, and or they're using different intermediaries, and so information is in error from an accidental point of view. And I have no comment on the percentages on this. I'm just telling you what we see. And then we see data that is inaccurate on purpose, and it is clearly there to mislead or to prevent contact. I think there may also be data that is inaccurate because someone is afraid they're going to get spammed, and they choose this method to prevent being spammed. But those are kind of the four areas that we see from an internal perspective as who is users across the wide number of, we use it as an ISP, we use it for trademark purposes, we use it for business contact purposes. We've got a pretty wide set of uses of who is across all of my company. And, you know, I do think that accuracy is going to bring additional, some method of keeping the data accurate will add cost to the registrars. At the same time, I also think that if there's not a response by the registrars in a proactive, useful, productive way, that there will be other mechanisms that are used to force them to make the data accurate, such as concerns by consumer protection agencies, concerns by lawmakers, etc., that could result in an answer that registrars wouldn't be happy with, because it would be enforced on them. It would be a mandated approach as opposed to one that they could develop as a code of conduct or practice and try to comply with.
Yes, this is Steve Metallis. Andrew, can I follow up with a question about the existing contract enforcement mechanism?
Go for it.
As you know, the OECD has posted on its website its letter asking ICANN to revoke the accreditation of one registrar based on its experience with that registrar, accepting, obviously, phony who is data and refusing to take action against repeated instances of this. How does ICANN react to, how does ICANN process that type of request, and do you know whether any action has been taken on that request?
As to the first part of your question, it goes to our legal department, which is Louis and Dan Halloran for registrar stuff. And since I'm no longer an officer at ICANN, I don't know what the status of that is.
Okay. Well, while I would agree with you that it would be in the interest of many players that we come up with some intermediate sanctions for violations of these agreements, I think it's also important that while that is being negotiated, which could be a rather protracted process, that the agreements be enforced now with the sanctions that are available now. So I will follow up with maybe with Louis and see if I can get a sense of what's happening on that.
Are there other points that people want to make about accuracy? I think, you know, we try to distinguish between accuracy and access, with the idea that data ought to be accurate, even if there's differential access to it or there's some other issue that arises about access, that data ought to be accurate. And I think I'm going to, as we move along a little bit later, Tony and I are going to ask sub-teams to come together to take the next step of work on a particular area. So,
right, yeah. Because somebody talking in some European language, I think, in the background.
It's Philip Robbins, yeah, I suppose.
Looks like Philip.
German, it sounds like Philip, yes.
Okay, so anything else on accuracy? And I think the work program that we're all thinking about is that 50 should be a priority, and we will try to put together a small team to work on looking at the recommendation, taking it to the next step, and probably also would like to think about what work is done already within the registrar constituents address. And are you or Tim in a position to comment on that?
Give me the question again, Merlin, so I can give you a decent answer.
I know. It's my question was, have the registrars themselves, and I guess actually the registries in the thick registry environment. So Karen, this, you may need to come back and respond to us for your constituency as well. I don't think Ram is on.
I am on, Maryland.
Oh, good, great. What work has been done so far within the constituencies to address the accuracy issue?
None.
Okay, and what about the thick registry?
We've had a number of conversations. This is Ram, and I'm speaking just for myself from Affilius right now, but Karen, jump in if you have something to add. We've only had informal discussions. There has, to the best of my knowledge, we've not had a formal discussion to resolve the accuracy and validation issues, but it's pretty high and hot on our agendas. There are a number of problems, including registrars who have information, accurate information in their local databases, but which are not updated in the thick registry database, essentially making thick registries a thin registry.
The very interesting thing that I'm seeing in looking at both the transfers task force and this task force is the cost to the registrars themselves of having inaccurate data. Because that may mean that their efforts to notify a registrant are going astray. But let's leave this topic and go to our next one.
Marilyn, it's Laurence. Can I just add something on this issue?
Yes.
I tend to really agree with you with by looking at the different type of data which are inaccurate. You mentioned old, by accident, on purpose. Regarding the fact that the registrar may have accurate data in reality, I think it will be important, and I don't know if other members agree, to underline the fact that the collaboration between the registrars and the registrants or other communities such as the trademark community or other communities is also essential. And the fact that when we note that some data are inaccurate, it's also important to see how the process will go on, you know, whether I've got an echo, it's really awful. whether a registrar will react, and how long will it take to react? So this notion of collaboration between registrars and registrants and other interested parties as well.
I think that's worth noting, because we're talking about this as though all the responsibility belongs with the registrars, but when a registrant has provided inaccurate information or incomplete information, then clearly there is an issue on the part of willful action by the registrant.
Yes, I agree as well. Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder if there's something to be learned from the ISP service agreement, where ISPs do write into their service agreement the ability to discontinue service if they're a subscriber. Things like spamming, etc., other things of that nature. But I think this discussion would probably need to include what is the responsibility of the registrant to provide accurate information and to respond in a timely manner, as the registrar is otherwise helpless.
A couple of questions, Marilyn. It's Ken.
Yes.
Maybe Steve can answer it or you can. First of all, correct me if I'm wrong, but has not somebody proposed the introduction of a bill in Congress that puts some pretty harsh penalties on people who provide fictitious or intentionally provide data for who is that's inaccurate? And number two, we're aware of the fact that coming up in September on I believe it's either the 18th or 19th, there's going to be a panel discussion, or at least a rather in-depth discussion with a significant number of the registrars and people from the Federal Trade Commission, law enforcement, and so forth. I'm wondering whether or not we'll have the opportunity of getting some of the input from those discussions into our group here.
That's the last point is really good, and let me address it first.
Marilyn, this is Ram. Just one comment on the previous question. I just wanted to make the point that what the registry constituency in general, what we have discussed, though, is right now registries have a fairly Boolean way to deal with problems with data accuracy with the registrar who is causing the problem. One of the things, and this is reflected in the document as well, one of the things that we're suggesting is rather than going for a draconian, you shall be de-accredited, to have a graduated method so that you get, an equivalent of a three strikes and you're out mechanism. So that's general, a registry, there is general consensus around that idea in the registry constituency.
There's general agreement in the registry constituency for a graduated sanction.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, there's been conversations about it, but we really, there hasn't been a full proposal put out. But there is general support for the idea that, that registries will work on a graduated sanctions method, and we've reflected that in the Who Is recommendations in our document. It's reflected in our document right now.
Graduated sanctions between the registries and the registrars.
Correct. The registries have no direct contractual relationship with registrants.
Right.
And therefore, it has to be between registries and registrars.
And that in. That is not an ICANN issue, Ram, or it is an ICANN issue?
Don't know yet. It might simply be a contractual issue between registries and registrars, and may not be an ICANN issue. I think general ICANN has broad support for validation or to have methods of validation and some sort of penalties associated with it.
Yeah.
Not doing it.
I just wanted to say something about Ken about the September 19th or 18th, whatever it is, meeting. But there's going to be a number of the registrars talking about access. I'd like to propose that we add. I have on my list of groups that we would like to hear from the registrars themselves, and so I don't know when the right time is, but I do think it would be good if we could, as part of our outreach, hear from a group of the registrars, and maybe this group that's preparing to talk to the FTC and other law enforcement entities would be a good approach to do that, since they will have done preparation. They wouldn't be reinventing the wheel, so to speak.
Marilyn, this is Steve Metallic. Between the echo, the buzz, and the crosstalk, it's getting increasingly hard to follow this call, but I seem to recall that Ken had asked a question to me, but I'm not sure what it was.
Steve, I asked you, I thought that Congress had just recently proposed
about the
bill
legislation,
out.
Right. Well, there is a bill has been proposed that would make it a violation of U.S. law to provide false Who Is data with intent to defraud, but I'm not sure whether that bill is going anywhere in the remaining month of the Congress. I hope that answers your question.
I have been trying.
Yes, it does, and I have to be honest with you, that buzzing is getting worse rather than better.
Guys, I'm trying to get the operator to come in and check the line, but in the meantime, can you try to mute it? I'm sorry about this, but when we do international calls, we do sometimes get noise. We will see if she appears in time to do anything about this. Let me move us to talking about the next topic, which is uniformity of data formats. Our recommendation in that case... actually, I need to ask someone else dialed in using the host code today because it was busy when I dialed into it. The host code number, if you remember what you dialed, is 126392. No one remembers doing that.
In any case, you shouldn't publish the host code, Marilyn.
It changes with every call.
Yeah, but only you need to know it.
Usually, but I'm trying to get the operator. And since I'm not the host, and actually, let's go back to focus on work here as much as we can. If you're using a speakerphone, could you pick the handset up? Let me try one other thing. Let me give everyone a different bridge to dial into. Sorry about the noise, but I guess it was equipment from some of the folks who were on the phone with us. If you put a laptop too close to some of the phones, it picks up that buzz. If you use you have a cell phone turned on too close to some of the electro. Bizarre, but some of the phones it will also set those up. Well, there's a few of us. We can talk about our second topic, even if it's a much smaller group, on uniformity of data formats and elements. Here, I think we really need to undertake some consultation with the registrars. We had also suggested about having an outreach session with VeriSign. And outreach with some of the CCTLDs.
Right. I have a suggestion to make on that.
Yes, Tony.
I think that if we try and achieve uniformity across the CCTLDs and the GTLDs, the data protection issue is gonna be a nightmare on that. And local laws, local conditions will be different in each country, and perhaps we should focus on the concept of worldwide uniformity as having more than one tier or one level of access. I think what everybody might agree to is that behind a shield which each country can define, you would have residing in each country exactly the same type of information on the same fields. But each country would inevitably, I think, want to condition who gets access and under what conditions to that information. Okay?
And you're speaking about the country codes in particular, right, Tony?
Well,